High up on buildings all over New York City, creatures carved of stone are glaring down on us. In his novel called The Gargoyle Hunters, John Freeman Gill combines the gargoyles we pass every day and the constant changes in the New York City streetscape with a coming of age story that is set during the financial crisis of 1974. It's published by Alfred A. Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought John Freeman Gill to our show today. Hello.
Hey.
Much of your nonfiction writing is about architecture and real estate, including frequent contributions to the Living In columns in the Sunday New York Times real estate section. Was it inevitable that if you were to write a novel, it would be about architecture?
Perhaps it was, but it goes way back to my childhood. My mother is a painter who painted lost city streets just as they were about to be lost, starting in the 50s. So she, for 60 years, has been painting streets just as they're about to be destroyed. And so when I was growing up, the walls of my apartment were covered with old lost New York. It was very much alive. You know, the 57th Street Automat was serving up cheesecake in our kitchen, and Bonwit Teller was selling haute couture dresses out of my mom's bedroom. So, and the house was also filled with all kinds of architectural salvage.
And some people have argued that that's one of the great things about New York, that it's constantly changing, and although you may lose some things, you gain other things.
I think that's right. I think it's a cycle of destruction and regeneration and recreation.
Have you been thinking for a while about writing fiction?
I've always thought of myself as a fiction writer who happens to write journalism. I went to an MFA program 100 years ago when I was in my early 20s.
But the process is different, writing fiction and nonfiction.
It's completely different, yeah.
Which neighborhood in New York did you grow up in?
I grew up in actually the building, until I was 12, I grew up in a building that became landmarked, a Queen Anne Row house on East 89th Street between Lex and 3rd, that was just part of a jostling group of six buildings, six row houses from the 1880s, you know.
And were you aware of that at the time, that there was something historic about where you were growing up?
No. Actually, the one thing that I was aware of is that my parents were divorced while I lived in that building. And my father, the building was coming up for landmarking, and my father was dead set against it being landmarked, as many homeowners are, because it limits what they can do with it and who they can sell to it. And my mother was a great lover of architecture and old things, and she was on the other side of the fence and wanted this beautiful old building preserved. And I would also say this building was very unusual because it was only about 12 feet wide, and it was bristling with ironwork and oriels and mansard roofs and all kinds of beautiful things. But no, as a child, it's just your home.
So have you drawn from that experience for this book? Because this is also about a couple that gets divorced, has a couple of kids.
Yeah, I think I drew from the experience for sure. I mean, most of the time I lived in that brownstone, my parents were divorced, and my mother was taking in a bunch of misfit boarders. The characters that are the mother in this book takes in a bunch of misfit boarders. The characters are all fictional, but I was populating the home of my childhood with characters of my imagination.
Why did you choose to set the novel in 1974, a time that's often considered one of the low points in the city's history?
Well, that's exactly right. That is why I chose to set it there. Novels develop gradually and in mysterious ways, but I think the moment I became very excited about what this novel could be was when I realized that I was in a position to tell a story that was at once a small, intimate story of a fracturing family, a father and son, and a big story about the near death of New York in 1974, 1975. So the two things were echoing each other. And at some point I realized, I started out with this smaller family story, the smaller story about a fragmenting family. And at some point I realized that the fragmentation of that family was really being echoed by the disintegration of 1970s New York, where I grew up.
And the gargoyles are a part of that story. Are all the gargoyle carvings that are they all things, waterspouts?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. Gargoyles are technically waterspouts. They're carved in the shape of grotesque humans or animals. But the title of this book, The Gargoyle Hunters, is taken from a 1962 New York Herald Tribune Sunday magazine story, which was called Gargoyle Hunters. It was called Gargoyle Hunting in New York. And it was all about regular citizens who were going to demolition sites all over the city, because just a few people recognized that thousands of these glorious carvings and castings from the late 19th and early 20th centuries were being destroyed, and something vital about the city's past and its artistic and architectural patrimony was being lost.
I remember a place on the Lower East Side, I think it was on Houston Street, where there were all these gargoyles and other things. There were columns from buildings. Yep. And, of course, the Brooklyn Museum has a collection of these ornaments. Is that still on display?
Well, it's a good question. You and I talked about this 6 years ago, because I wrote a feature for the Atlantic Monthly on the rescue and salvage of hundreds of these objects, which were given to the Brooklyn Museum. The Brooklyn Museum had a beautiful sculpture garden that was mostly dismantled in 2000 when they expanded their parking lot. And they, for more than 15 years, a lot of these have been sort of encamped in the sad refugee camp behind a chain link fence. But I did actually go by there this morning. I happen to live across the street. And there's a new leadership there, and they have begun to hang up some of these really beautiful 19th century carvings. They seem to be showing more respect for them now.
Should we think of them as artworks?
I think we should think of them as artworks. What they are is the vernacular city. What you had in the late 19th century, basically around 1879, when the elevated trains were going up, were being run up the 3rd Avenue, 9th Avenue, that brought with it all the tenements, and all the people were pouring off, the immigrants were pouring off the boats and basically clattering uptown on these on the elevated trains. And at that time, the immigrants were coming and basically designing their own housing. So what you had is these absolutely gifted artisans from the British Isles and Italy and Germany coming here and really incising their imaginations into the streetscape of our city. They turned our city, the city that I grew up in and the city that you know so well, into just these absolutely marvelously quirky public art galleries.
And many of those buildings have been knocked down, or did they just kind of fall apart? For a time, there was the north of 14th Street up until the Flatiron Building. They took all of the ornamentation off of some of those wonderful old buildings.
Well, there was a Local Law 10 and Local Law 11 that requires landlords to inspect their buildings every 5 years. And when those laws came in, a lot of these landlords said, "The hell with it! I don't want some carved goddess falling on somebody's head. I don't want my zinc, beautiful Italian zinc cornice falling on people's heads." And they found that their interest in saving a buck outstripped their interest in being stewards of our architectural
and
patrimony.
So they stripped all the ornamentation off of our only Louis Sullivan building in New York on Bleecker Street. I think some of that stuff has been restored only recently.
Some of it has been restored for sure.
What's the difference between a gargoyle and a grotesque?
A grotesque, I mean, the gargoyle literally is, as we discussed, a water spout. A grotesque comes from, it's an Italian word, it comes from a grotto, a kind of cave-like place.
Were the gargoyles and grotesque originally intended also to protect residents from evil spirits?
I think that is a traditional purpose. But if you go to Notre Dame or something, they're really basically there just to keep the water from spitting down on the churchgoers.
And are there areas where I could still go and enjoy seeing the gargoyles?
Sure. Well, if you still live in Park Slope, they're all over the place. If you look around in almost any tenement neighborhood, I mean, the point of this is that we had an almost indigenous art form, or at least a distinctive American art form. What happened is the carvers who came over from Europe were very well trained, but in Europe they were told what to do. And when they came here, if you look at the blueprints from that period, unless you're talking about a high-end architect like McKim Mead and White, the ornamentation was never particularly prescribed. It wasn't. If you look at the blueprints, they just over a window where the keystone's supposed to be, it'll just say carving. So these carvers would go and the foreman would say, give me a Moses if he wanted some bearded dude, or he'd say, oh, give me a Mary if he wanted some goddess or some Athena. And what happened is that this gave free rein to the carver's imaginations, and they started to carve their friends and their sweethearts and the barkeep. So if you walk around the streets of New York right now, you literally are seeing late 19th century New Yorkers staring back at you out of the stone. And it's not just glamorous buildings, it's tenements. Walk around any kind of landmark neighborhood like Park Slope or the Upper West Side or tenement neighborhoods. Even the lowliest tenements have the most beautiful, fanciful creatures and humans looking back down at you.
I'm speaking with John Freeman Gill, who's written a novel called The Gargoyle Hunters. Were there a lot of gargoyle hunters?
I don't know if there were a lot. You know, the main source for this book, I interviewed a lot of the people who did this.
Is this a polite term for scavenger?
I suppose it is. They called themselves rubble rousers as well. But it was starting in the 50s, a guy called Ivan Karp, who became a famous art dealer. He basically discovered or at least popularized Andy Warhol. He was walking down the street one day. He's a main source for this book. But he was walking down the street one day in the 50s, and he looked down at his feet, and there was a beautiful terracotta cherub at his feet. And he struggled to, you know, 15 or 20 pounds. He took it home. He put it on his kitchen table, and he looked at it, and he said, "My God, this must be going on all over the city." And he got a band of these rubble rousers together. They called themselves the Anonymous Arts Recovery Society because many of these artisans, most of these artisans are unknown. They're just regular New York immigrants. And he saved, you know, 1,500 of them for posterity.
The narrator of your novel is 13-year-old Griffin Watts, and his father is works in antiques restoration. What is his motivation for salvaging architecture ornaments?
Well, now we get into sort of the novel and
I should mention that there is a plot to this book.
There certainly is. Well, so Griffin is in the aftermath of this difficult divorce. His father on the surface, he's an antiques dealer, but what he really is he runs an illicit and very dangerous architectural salvage operation. And Griffin, who really just deeply wants to be close to his father, that's really his only motivation. His father's aloof and mysterious and very charismatic, one of those magnetic people want to be around, recruits him into his business. And Griffin is very small and nimble, so he can get into places that an adult can't. So his father sends him around in very treacherous situations, climbing all around the tops of iconic skyscrapers and tenements all over New York City to literally, sometimes with power saws, sometimes with crowbars, to literally steal architectural sculptures off of the faces of extant New York buildings. Some of them are not even about to be destroyed. So the father fancies himself a preservationist, but he enters this moral gray area where is he rescuing or is he just a common thief?
This is the same argument that the British Museum has for keeping the Elgin marbles.
It certainly is.
Now, what is the greater risk, falling off of a roof or getting arrested?
You know, it's a funny question because in the 70s, the world has changed so much now, or the city has changed so much. You know, you can't climb around buildings. The way we did as we were kids, we'd sort of climb into anything that looked interesting. I remember even in my 20s climbing up cranes in the East Village. You can't do anything like that in New York City anymore. But in the 70s, these lots were not guarded. There might have been, you know, a plywood fence you had to climb over, but you could steal these things, or you were technically stealing them, but they were all headed for the landfill anyway. So what you were really doing is rescuing artworks for posterity.
Now, some of them were these gargoyles were made of cast iron. We saw a lot of them in Soho. You write about the Bogardus building.
Right. Well, you asked earlier why I set the book in 1974. And in fact, that's one of the main reasons. I wanted to write about the near death of New York City and the fragmentation of this boy's family is echoed by the fragmentation of the city. But there was also a very specific event that very few people remember, which is that in 1974, an entire landmark New York City building was literally stolen from cornice to curb. And it was a cast iron building, and it scandalized the city and the Landmarks Preservation Commission, under whose protection it was, and it made the front page of the New York Times. But nobody knows what ever happened to that building. That building was stolen. And I don't want to give it away to the readers. How could thieves actually steal a building? But they literally did. And no one knows what happened. So I wanted to know the end of that story. How could someone steal a building and what would happen to that building? And so I sat down and wrote that story.
And you set your climactic scene with Griffin on top of the Woolworth building.
That's right.
Weren't you able to interview a preservation architect who had been on scaffolding near the top of the Woolworth Building?
That's right. A terrific guy called Tim Allenbrook, who ended up as the deputy project manager. In the 1970s, the Woolworth Building basically had been, the terracotta had been failing. It's basically since it was put on the building.
People consider it one of the most beautiful buildings in New York, and it was our first skyscraper.
And it was the tallest building in the world. I don't know if it was the first skyscraper, but it was the tallest building in the world when it was built in the 1960s. And the terracotta at the top of that building was absolutely beautiful. And there are four little towers called Tourelles, which are really the jewels of the crown. And this is a true story. I built the story of my novel around this. But in interviewing Tim, I learned that those Tourelles in the 1970s were completely stripped of their beautiful terracotta because it was such a difficult preservation problem. And they were replaced with glorified aluminum siding. And there were 32 gargoyles up there. This is a true story. I had imagined this story, that there would be gargoyles up there. And then putting my journalist hat on, I interviewed Tim and dove into the archives and so forth. It turned out there had been 32 gargoyles up there. And they were all stripped to make way for this aluminum siding. And so in my book, I imagined what would happen if the father, the obsessive manic father, takes Griffin in the middle of the night to save the last surviving gargoyle off the top of the building. He literally sends the kid up there with the chainsaw to saw it off. And this preservation architect, I was hoping, because of course the Woolworth is a real building, he would maybe have, I said, do you have a snapshot or something from when you were on the scaffolds back then? And he said, well, as a matter of fact, John, I have an entire PowerPoint presentation about my restoration project that we did back then, and I'd be happy to show it to you. And then he showed me all kinds of unpublished diagrams and photographs, and he literally walked my characters around the top of the building and helped me puzzle out how they would go about sawing a gargoyle off the top of a building with a chainsaw.
You can't get into the Woolworth Building the way you used to in the past. Was it damaged at all by 9/11?
No, not that I know of. And to be fair, they are doing a really beautiful restoration job even now.
Luxury condominiums.
Yeah, the Pinnacle. There's a 7-story penthouse in the Pinnacle that's supposed to go on the market any day now for 110 million big ones.
Do you agree with a character's comment that New Yorkers will never take the time to look up at the city around them? Was that always the case? Because they must have assumed people would see these gargoyles when they put them up in the first place.
Well, I think when you're talking about keystone portraits over doorways on row houses or tenements, I think that's to give a sense of surface sumptuousness to buildings that might even be humble. It's really a sales tool. But yes, I believe that people don't look up in New York. New York's always been a city of sort of bustle and transaction. And one day, you'd mentioned the Woolworth Building, one day when I was writing for the Times in around 2005, I looked up, because I always look up, and I saw that the roof of the, you know, that famous oxidized copper green roof of the Woolworth Building had turned white. And to me, it was as if, you know, the Statue of Liberty had gotten a dye job. So I called up and I found out what was going on there, and that it was primer and there was nothing wrong with that. But I went and interviewed people in the neighborhood, and nobody who worked or lived in the neighborhood had noticed that this iconic, internationally famous building had its entire roof had changed color. And I talked to, you know, the old New York Times building where Pace University is now, right across City Hall Park on Park Row. Pace University is there, so I talked to some students, and one of them sort of eye-rollingly looked at me, a girl looked at me and said, well, it's not like I look up all the time.
Did your parents collect gargoyles or any of the other artifacts that, were they scavengers?
Yes, my mother
so
was.
So did you inherit any of them?
I'm working on it. Yes, my mother gave me a couple of terracotta spandrels that I have actually not yet taken from her house. But in the 1950s, when during the post-war boom, when the 3rd Avenue L, the elevated train, got torn down, of course, there's a big building boom all along 3rd Avenue, and that meant that all these tenements, which, you know, no one who could afford to would want to live near the 3rd Avenue L. It was loud and smelly and so forth, polluted. But when those came down, my mother would go along as the tenements and row houses were being destroyed, and she would actually oust my older sister Tracy from her stroller and use the stroller to put a snarling gargoyle keystone in there or a terracotta spandrel and struggle home with it.
John Freeman Gill's book, published by Knopf, is The Gargoyle Hunters. He writes frequently about architecture and real estate and is a contributor to the Living In column in the Sunday New York Times. Thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure.